Good afternoon. I'm Mark Schneider, the International Crisis Group, and I want to express my appreciation to my good friend Ginny Beauvier and the U.S. Institute of Peace for the opportunity to moderate this afternoon's panel, launching a very special book. The authors of the blurbs in the front of the book, Columbia Building Peace in a Time of War, extol its virtues. And when you read who is providing those blurbs, it's clear that this book has been written by scholars, analysts, and activists who know Columbia. They've walked through its coffee fields, seen its coca plants, but also seen its flowers, marveled at its soaring mountains and volcanoes, and its almost incomparable biodiversity. They know its people. They're resolute and absolutely determined to help bring an end to what has become the longest-lasting civil war on the face of the earth. Now, I first ventured to Columbia in 1968. It was sort of a post-Peace Corps valedictory trip to South America, I suppose. I've been back dozens of times, and each time I, too, am astounded at the richness of the land, the talents of its people, and the deep structural inequities that tarnish a resilient democracy. For those of us who have held government office, who work in NGOs, or who seek to advance respect for human rights, human dignity, and peace, the conflict in Colombia has been and is frustrating and tragic. Thus far, we've been unable to help Colombians find a path to lasting peace. Colombia has been a battlefield not only of civil conflict with multiple historical roots and societal origins, but where three wars have been fought: the Cold War, the war against drugs, and the war on terror. In all of these wars, particularly the last, Colombia and its citizens truly have been the victims, with almost no justification. What's clear from the essays in this volume and from the work of the International Crisis Group over the past 8 years is that the current democratic security policy of the Colombian government, which has relied almost entirely on military might to end the conflict, has not and is unlikely to be sufficient to achieve that goal. It also has been guilty of gross violations of human rights and international humanitarian law, including extrajudicial executions, falsos positivos, and other abuses. The deplorable humanitarian consequences of the conflict and the policy are evident, even in the last 3 years, when CODIS, for example, estimates that 221,000 new displaced took place in 2006, 305,000 newly displaced in 2007, and 380,000 newly displaced in 2008. The FARC is weaker, as we have seen, but we've also seen that it adapts. In its own strategy of kidnapping and mining rural roads and carrying out attacks on civilians and security forces, also produces more victims. A comprehensive peace strategy must simply go beyond armed force. There must be a serious extension of civilian authority, legitimacy, infrastructure, and services of the state that address the continuing levels of exclusion and underrepresentation of Afro-Colombians, indigenous Colombians, and the rural poor. There also must be a serious political strategy that does more to respond to the rights of victims, that pursues justice, that broadens democratic participation, and that builds on the courageous, imaginative, and ultimately optimistic endeavors at peace building described in this volume. Most people, most observers agree that the Colombian conflict is only going to be resolved through a negotiated process. But that requires a political strategy and a strategy to achieve that negotiation. And that's been missing for the past 8 years. I sound very pessimistic, and to some degree I am. But this volume, in fact, is very optimistic. It provides a sense of hope. And it inspired me to reread the words of Gabriel Garcia Marquez on accepting the Nobel Prize for Literature. He said that Colombians and others, and I quote, feel entitled to believe that it is not yet too late to engage in the creation of a new and sweeping utopia of life where no one will be able to decide for others how they will die, where love will prove true and happiness be possible, and where the races condemned to 100 years of solitude will have at last and forever a second opportunity on Earth. Thank you. Now let me introduce the panelists this afternoon. First and truly foremost is Virginia Bouvier. She is the person who conceptualized the project, managed it, edited the volume, and offers valuable recommendations in its conclusion for moving forward toward peace. Ginny is a senior program officer here at the United States Institute of Peace, where she heads the Columbia Conflict Team and the Columbia Grants Initiative. Next will be Dr. Mark Chernick, Research Associate Professor in the Department of Government in the Center for Latin American Studies at Georgetown University, and author of Acuerdo Posible, Solución Negociada al Conflicto Armado Colombiano. He's written extensively on conflict prevention, drug trafficking, internal armed conflicts, and how to end them. Dr. Chernick has been a consultant to nearly every U.S. and international organization engaged in and concerned with contributing to peace in Colombia. Next is Dr. Mary Roldan, Associate Professor of Latin American History at Cornell University. Her research and writing on Colombian history, violence, narcotics trafficking are recognized in Colombia and elsewhere. Her book, A Sangre y Fuego, La Violencia en Antioquia, Colombia, 1946-53, won the prestigious Colombian Research Prize. And finally, Adam Isaacson. Since 1995, Adam has been the coordinator of the program on Latin America and the Caribbean at the Center for International Policy, an independent research and advocacy organization. The program monitors U.S. military and security policy in the region, and Adam has become one of the most knowledgeable experts on Plan Colombia, security policy in the region, drug trafficking, the counter-drug policy, and the Colombian conflict. And now let me introduce Ginny.
Thank you, Mark, for your eloquent remarks. This day has been a long time coming, as my authors in particular know. I'm delighted to share the podium today with Mark Schneider, as well as with three of the contributing authors, Mark Chernick, Mary Roldan, and Adam Isaacson. I'd also like to recognize two of the other chapter authors who are here in the audience, Barb Gerlach here in the front, if you want to stand, and Jim Jones. A number of others RSVP'd, but I don't see them yet, so if there's any other author that's here that I just don't see, please feel free to stand. Is Chris Mitchell in the back? And Arturo Carrillo? It's not arrived, okay. I'd like to acknowledge the critical role that each of these individuals and the other contributors who are not here today played in the evolution of the project that led to the publication of today's book, Colombia Building Peace in a Time of War. It's been a team effort from the start, and I want to recognize both their intellectual contributions as well as their commitment and responsiveness to the many deadlines and demands throughout the course of a 5-year project. My husband Jim and daughter Maya have also joined us for this occasion. I'd like to recognize and thank them for their ongoing support. And finally, I thank my colleagues and leadership at the U.S. Institute of Peace and the U.S. Institute of Peace Press, many of whom are here today, for their ongoing support in seeing this book to fruition. I'd like to say a few words about the purpose of the book and what I hope it will contribute to discussions on Colombia in particular and peace more generally, as well as a few words about the process of putting it together. I'll not try to summarize the book. It's a long book, after all. But I will leave it to my colleagues on the panel to speak more concretely about lessons from past peace processes and regional peace initiatives and the policy options for the United States. The main goal of this book is to generate discussion and ideas about what it means to promote peace in Colombia and to help reframe debates on Colombia to ensure that peace becomes a more explicit part of U.S. policy agendas and goals. The book is meant to facilitate these discussions by illuminating the nature and the extent of past and current peace initiatives in Colombia, the range of roles that civil society has played in peace processes broadly defined, and the lessons that can be garnered from the successes and failures of past peace efforts. Finally, I hope the lessons generated in this volume will be of use to those seeking peace in other zones of conflict. The idea for this book has been simmering since I went to Colombia for USIP in February 2003 on a delegation led by Congressman Jim McGovern and organized by the Washington Office on Latin America. The elite Club Nogal in Bogota had just been bombed, killing dozens of people, and a plane had crashed in southern Colombia in territory controlled by the FARC, Colombia's largest guerrilla group. The plane carried five U.S. government contractors, three of whom were then taken hostage for 5.5 years. Both events made headlines in the United States and were a reminder that although Colombia is often a bit off the radar of most of the American public, the internal armed conflict there continues apace. About 4 million people have been internally displaced by the conflict. The numbers of landmine victims in Colombia are the highest in the world after Afghanistan. And the conflict is increasingly impacting the entire Andean region, with about 1 million Colombians having fled across the borders to seek refuge in neighboring countries. Security has improved on some fronts, especially in the cities, but extrajudicial executions, killings, threats, and harassment of social leaders, including peace and human rights activists and labor leaders, continue to be of concern. The U.S. government has invested heavily in Colombia, which, among other things, is the source of 90% of the cocaine that enters the United States. Its embassy in Bogota is second in size only to that in Baghdad, and it hosts some 2,000 employees representing 32 U.S. agencies. Colombia has been one of our top foreign aid recipients in the last decade, and since 2000, the U.S. government has invested more than $5 billion in bilateral aid, mostly in police and military assistance to that country. The U.S. policy agenda is driven simultaneously by a multitude of interests: counter-narcotics, counter-insurgency, counter-terrorism, trade, democracy, human rights, the rule of law, socioeconomic development, and humanitarian needs. Peace and regional security is integral to each of these. When I traveled to Colombia in 2003, national peace initiatives had stagnated. After 4 years of talks, President Pastrana had failed to secure a peace accord with the FARC. President Uribe had assumed office with broad popular support on a platform that promised a hardline policy toward the guerrillas. The underlying question of that trip, and the one that has driven this book project since, is what does it mean to support peace in Colombia, particularly when there are no national peace talks? Ordinarily, when we think of peacemaking, we think of what are known as track one negotiations between official representatives of governments and representatives of armed groups. Yet this view disregards the broader context of peacemaking and the range of track two or other civil society efforts to bring peace. These initiatives are often related to the official efforts, but they are also autonomous and can help to create the space and the political will necessary to jumpstart national initiatives. So while there are no official peace talks currently underway in Colombia, there are nonetheless plenty of initiatives that might be supported. Colombians in all parts of the country, in all sectors and of all backgrounds, have continued to hone and develop thousands and thousands of peace initiatives. These creative responses to the conflict are relatively unexamined in the academic literature and have been little known in the English-speaking world. The Colombians and others who have led, participated in, and studied these initiatives are the inspiration for the book we're launching today, and they are the key stakeholders in Colombia's future. Building peace is about bringing people together who don't usually talk to each other to exchange ideas and find ways to move forward. In that sense, this book project has been an exercise in peace building. Mostly it has been nonviolent exchanges, but it has been a process of dialogue to share experiences and generate knowledge in the search for solutions. And hopefully the resulting book will generate further opportunities to engage in the numerous dialogues needed to advance peace in Colombia. For the book project, I assembled a team of experts to help map out the landscape of conflict and peace in Colombia. I contacted former USIP grantees and peace scholars who had worked on these issues and invited them to write papers for academic panels and conferences, including one organized at Cornell University by Mary Roldan. I sought authors who could analyze the different trajectories of armed actors and the different peace actors. For purposes, I sought authors who were steeped in particular geographic regions or who were familiar with initiatives in particular sectors of Colombian society, such as the churches, the education sector, the business sector, the military, as well as individuals who could write about experiences of indigenous, Afro-Colombians, women, peasants, and the internally displaced. I engaged individuals who knew something about the different peace processes that had been tried by earlier Colombian administrations and who had followed negotiation attempts with the major armed groups. I looked to involve individuals who knew something as well about the international community and how it has engaged with peace efforts in Colombia. Where scholarship was lacking, I invited practitioners to reflect on and theorize about their own experiences. I encouraged authors to team up across national and disciplinary lines, to write their chapters, to read and comment on each other's work, and to consider the factors that seemed to facilitate successful peace initiatives and the factors that inhibited success. The resulting book brings together the experiences and insights of 31 seasoned and emerging scholars, journalists, policy analysts, and peace and development practitioners, half of whom are in Colombia. They bring a range of perspectives from the fields of political science, anthropology, history, psychology, education, and peace and conflict studies. In considering how to support peace in Colombia, the authors of this book needed to address explicitly or implicitly a number of related issues and questions. First, what do we mean by peace? Is peace a goal, such as ending organized violence, or achieving a more just society? Or is peace a process by which mechanisms are established to resolve conflict nonviolently? The way peace is defined has important implications for questions of human rights, security, and development, and it determines, at least in part, the mechanisms required for truth, justice, reparations, and reconciliation. A second related question is, what strategies have been tried to secure peace in Colombia, and what strategies have yet to be tried? Most of us know something about the conflict in Colombia, which has its roots in the partisan violence that left 200,000 people dead in the 1940s and 50s, in the period known as La Violencia. We're somewhat familiar with the tremendous economic inequities and the history of political and social exclusion that gave rise to a variety of guerrilla insurgencies in the 1960s. We've seen the penetration and corruption of Colombian institutions and the targeting of social leaders by paramilitaries, sometimes linked to drug traffickers and the mafia, and sometimes colluding with government officials. And we've seen how drugs and money laundering continue to make this conflict particularly intransigent. Most of us know far less about the rich history of peace initiatives in Colombia. In the last 25 years, Colombian governments have alternated between strategies of war and strategies of peace in their efforts to deal with illegal armed groups. They have accrued some successes, in particular securing the demobilization of numerous armed groups in the last decades, and they have made repeated, albeit not fully successful, attempts to bring the two main armed groups, the FARC and the ELN, to the peace table. Internationals have been involved in multiple ways in these efforts. Increasingly, as unarmed actors have become the major victims of conflict, they too have developed initiatives to bring peace. Members of civil society, particularly women, have negotiated with armed actors to release kidnapped victims, to prevent the displacement of communities, and to allow safe passage of foods and medicines past armed blockades. Citizens have sponsored initiatives to promote electoral debates, address corruption, and contribute to development plans. They've established peace communities, or zones of peace, where armed actors are not allowed to enter. Youth have spearheaded drives for popular education. The contributors to this book document, analyze, and theorize about the nature and extent of such initiatives in Colombia. They analyze initiatives in the smallest hamlets and municipalities, at the regional and departmental levels, and at the national level. They examine Colombian government efforts to negotiate peace and the international community's engagement in Colombia through governments, NGOs, and international organizations. Articulating and comparing these different levels of engagement allows a variety of new analytical approaches to peace initiatives to emerge. Among other things, for example, the book underscores the potential of gender, ethnicity, region, and religion to create relationships and build trust across the many barriers and inequities that divide Colombian society. This positive role is particularly striking given that in so many conflicts around the world, ethnicity and religion in particular are more likely to be sources of violence than sources of peace. And the potential of gender and region for strengthening a constituency for peace has yet to be fully recognized or realized. A third issue the authors considered in their quest to ascertain what it means to promote peace in Colombia is what has worked and what has not, and why. Here we find tremendous variation by level and by region, and we enter into discussion about what might constitute success in each context. I'll let my fellow panelists address what they found in writing their chapters. Mark Chernick will discuss lessons learned from his analysis of FARC negotiating practices over the past 25 years, Mary Roldan will share with us her assessment of regional peace initiatives, particularly the peace laboratory model being implemented in Antioquia and elsewhere with varying results. Finally, Adam Isaacson will walk us through thinking about what a peace-centered policy might look like for the United States. Again, I thank you all for being here, and I look forward to today's presentations and to the discussion that will follow.
Thank you, Ginny, and thank you, Mark. It's a great pleasure to be here, and the book looks stunning. As Ginny just mentioned, my chapter was a look at the FARC and its positions during over 25 years of negotiations. Negotiations in a peace process mean negotiations with an armed opposition group. If there's going to be peace in Colombia, there's going to be a peace process in Colombia, it will mean negotiations with the FARC, and it will go through negotiations with the FARC. So what I set out to do is to look at what were the positions that the FARC brought to the table. Colombia has, as Mark Schneider said, one of the longest histories, if not the longest history, of armed conflict in contemporary history. You have to go to Israel, Palestine, Kashmir, as 47-48, to have a conflict this protracted. Colombia also has an extraordinarily rich history of attempted peacemaking. Most of those peace processes failed. But during the last, beginning in 1982, there were five presidents, really from 1982 to 2002, five presidents each attempted some sort of peace process. That changed to a great degree after 2002 with the rise of Alvaro Uribe, who I'll discuss. But in that time, in 1984, President Betancourt signed a ceasefire agreement with the FARC. The FARC went on to found a political party, Patriotic Union, which was then mostly dismantled, assassinated, slaughtered. There were negotiations in Caracas and Tlaxcala, 1991-92. And then there was the interesting period during the Pastrana years, 98 to 2002, negotiations in southern Colombia and Caguan, where the state gave a demilitarized zone to the FARC to facilitate negotiations. During these negotiations, the FARC was ultimately quite consistent in what it was asking. The FARC was, since its founding, it was allied with the Communist Party. It's always been deeply shaped by a Marxist ideology. And yet what they brought to the negotiating table were proposals for reform. At the centerpiece of the reform was agrarian reform, rural development, small farm holdings, a vision, many say, of a Colombia based in sort of 1950s small-scale farming. That, if you look at, they have a major document. My chapter basically goes through all this. But you look at the agrarian program 1962 and their agrarian proposals in 1999, it's the same document. What they add are a broader history of the conflict, and they add the coca-growing regions. That's what changed. The agrarian frontier, the conflict moving into what they call the agrarian frontier, the extension of the population zones into new areas where the state had no presence, and here, deep into the jungle, that was new areas of conflict, and so they had proposals about what to do along the agrarian frontier around coca-growing. But that, the agrarian issue has been at the core. But they also came up with proposals for deeper democracy. The idea of direct election of mayors was a FARC banner throughout the 80s. And in fact, the political system adopts it and then put a direct election of governor. They still proposed the direct election of attorney general. They talked about revised security strategies. They talk about greater social spending. You look at the demands there, and their demands for political reforms that have long been deferred, long been needed, and which have generated conflict. They are not reforms for a Marxist transformation of society. It's quite extraordinary. I wrote my doctoral dissertation on the very first peace process with the FARC during the Betancourt years in the early 80s. And I brought back the agenda to my dissertation committee, and one was a Marxist French scholar, and he said, but this is what they're asking for? And it's a very important point. No. All of these peace processes failed. Why? There's a lot of analysis that can be done, but one thing that you can say, should say, is that both the FARC and the government didn't come to the table with consensus among themselves about where they want to go. That is, parts of the FARC saw negotiations as a tactic to further their political strategy, and others saw it and their military strategy, and others saw it as actually a possibility to make peace. Same thing on the government side. In fact, the most of the government negotiators have found tremendous opposition with any proposal of reform. So there hasn't been consensus on either side. And if you know the work in conflict resolution theory, one of the things that leads to the breakdowns of peace process is the advent of spoilers. And spoilers come from inside the parties at the negotiating table. And here we had spoilers from the state side and spoilers from the insurgent side. And then we had a major spoiler from outside called the paramilitaries. And so the lack of consensus and the inability to deal with spoilers. The other is, and this relates to that, there is this idea that when you go to the negotiating table, you need to show strength outside the negotiating table. And every time they go to the negotiating table, there's an increase in violence, with this idea that that'll translate to leverage at the negotiating table. And yet what it did is it led to the rise of the spoilers and to the breakdown of the talks, which leads to the final point, which I'll mention because it's actually a long list of lessons. At no time was there any sort of adequate mediation. Up until Caguan in the late 90s, there was no mediation. The government assumed the role of party of the conflict and mediator. In Caguan, there was the beginnings of the invitation to bring in the international community, and yet the international community, there was a UN special representative, a special representative of the Secretary General, but he had no authority. And in fact, the FARC and the government made the special advisor sit outside the room when actual negotiations took place. And then there was the same thing with a 10-member group of friends. There was no authority. Mediation is key. Somebody has to make sure the sides stay at the negotiating table. Okay. Since 2002, this idea of this conflict will end through a negotiated settlement, which was at the centerpiece of Colombian politics for 20 years and was at the core of each presidential election, 82, 86, 90, 94, and 98. 2002, a new idea emerged. Perhaps there's a military solution to this conflict. In 2002, of course, was when we, as Mark talks about the changing international context, the United States and the world was just addressing this idea of a war on terror. Colombia embraced this idea of a war on terror. It reconceived the conflict not as one of a conflict which generates out of social and political and economic issues and exclusions, but of one of terrorists who are threatening society. And in the Colombian context, the use of terrorism, this is almost unique to Colombia. It's not terrorism attached to a political goal. Here it's terrorism attached to no goal, terrorism by itself. And the conflict was recast from this idea that scholars and practitioners and politicians and NGOs had long understood as one of generating out of root causes and social conflicts and political exclusion to one of terrorists that needed to be addressed. That led to a new policy of perhaps there's a military solution to the conflict. The idea of negotiating with the FARC gave way to a full-scale strategy to defeat the FARC. Attached to Plan Colombia became a new strategy largely financed by the United States, Plan Patriota. 18,000 Colombian troops assisted by the United States to move into the heart of FARC territory, to go after their leadership and to bring their leadership down. It led to the most intense combat we've seen in 40 years of conflict since the founding of the FARC. The conflict antedates the founding of the FARC. But the most intense conflict, and you look at the intensity levels of conflict, and we have this spike going up 2002-2007. Largely, the early days of Plan Patriota yielded little results. It was surprising. One thing they did do, though, is they pushed back the FARC from its strongholds closer to the cities. If you go back to that first peace process in the early 80s when the FARC had multiple strategies, peace and build up the military side, the FARC initiates a strategy in the early 80s to basically surround Bogota. If you know Colombia, there's three cordilleras, and Bogota's in the eastern cordillera. To place fronts, that's their major political unit, around Bogota. Well, one thing the early stages of the Plan Patriota did is dismantled 20 years of military strategy of the FARC of coming close to the cities. But deep into the heartlands of the FARC, southern Colombia, there was little progress made. Now, along with the idea of a militarized strategy with the FARC was also a novel concept, negotiations with the paramilitary forces. Now, what's interesting about this is that most people who understand peace processes and study peace processes are about negotiations with the armed opposition. That's where I started. Well, the paramilitaries don't, in fact, represent an armed opposition. They represent an armed group that has alliances with the FARC and, has alliances with the state and shares the FARC as an enemy with the state. And yet there was a program to demobilize the paramilitaries. Now, I always thought, fine, you need to demobilize the paramilitaries. The state is responsible for demobilizing the paramilitaries. That, if we could get the paramilitaries off the battlefield, that will be progress. That will sharpen the conflict and make peace more possible. So the idea of demobilizing the paramilitaries didn't represent a peace process, but a necessary, important step. And then together with that, during the first and second administrations of Uribe, we started some negotiations around with the ELN, second group, which failed. And there's a chapter in the book about the ELN, and also around a humanitarian accord, the exchange of prisoners. I won't go into all that. We can maybe talk about that. What's been the result of these strategies? The demobilization of the paramilitaries, in fact, led to an extraordinary process of demobilization. Over 30,000 paramilitaries have demobilized. That was probably three times the number of what anyone estimated paramilitary fighting forces consisted of. And yet, 2-3 years later, we have process of remobilized paramilitaries. That paramilitarism has not been dismantled, and paramilitary power has actually been consolidated throughout the national territory. The FARC has been clearly weakened, but the FARC still persists. The FARC took some major hits in 2008. One of their senior leaders was killed. Their historic leader died of a heart attack. Another senior member was killed by his own bodyguards, and there has been a weakening of their forces through both military and through a policy of demobilization. And yet the FARC persists. My sense is that the strategy of Uribe, demobilized paramilitary force against the FARC, has changed the nature of the battlefield. The conflict looks very different today than it did 5 years ago. In Colombia, the Colombian government talks about a post-conflict situation. That's not right. We're not in a post-conflict situation. The conflict has been transformed. Before the demobilization of the paramilitaries, they talked about there is no conflict. There is no armed conflict in Colombia. There's just terrorists. Now they use the language post-conflict. Neither was right. There is a conflict. It persists. And the strategies of force plus demobilization have probably reached their limits. There's a new status quo. It's an uncomfortable status quo. And it's a status quo which has left paramilitarism with great authority over large areas of the national territory. It's one that has led to perhaps the greatest humanitarian crisis on Earth, that of the IDPs. It's one that coexists with great and massive violations of human rights, but with a sense of security in the cities. This strategy can lead to a continuation of this status quo, but it won't lead to peace. Peace will require a political strategy and a strategy of negotiations. That will have to be done with the FARC, whether you like it or not. It will have to be comprehensive and involve more than the FARC, other groups, and also civil society and political society. But it is the only way forward. Will it happen? It's hard to imagine happening immediately. One of the results of the last 8 years has been a great public aversion to the idea of negotiations. That will have to change. That will have to come from the top. It will either have to come from this government of Uribe to the next government of a re-elected Uribe or a new government, where there will have to be a major move to educate the population once again about the value of a peace process. But I would say this, and I'll end here. One of the things we're seeing in the FARC as it's adapted to its new circumstances is that the FARC has new leadership. For the first time ever, the FARC's not led by old, former liberal peasants. It's now led by an urban, educated group. That's different. I would explore that. You should explore what they have to say. The FARC has been sending messages through the releases, through the desires for humanitarian accord. Very few are listening, but one needs to listen. One needs to test that. One should begin testing that now. And perhaps in the 1 year that remains in Uribe's term and in the beginning of the next one, some of this will begin to sow fruit. Thank you.
One of those nightmare experiences shortly before this panel began of losing everything on my computer. So I'm going to ad-lib this and try to do a good job of it. And I'm going to be brief so that there's room for some questions. I wrote a chapter about the Oriente Antioqueño and the struggles on the part of this community to form a solidarity movement among 23 municipalities to search for a negotiated out peaceful negotiations to the armed conflict that affected the region and that escalated dramatically as of the mid to late 1990s when various armed actors were operating in the area, the FARC, the ELN, the Colombian military, narcotics traffickers, paramilitaries, etc. And this was one of the most severely affected regions in Colombia. So I think in certain ways it's very representative of the possibilities and limitations that something like a peace laboratory might represent as a model for other areas of Colombia, but also potentially as a model to be adopted in other areas of the world that might be facing similar kinds of issues. And I'm going to have to be like Mark Schneider, which is I'm a little bit pessimistic. After many years of sort of observing and accompanying these communities and watching the evolution of their struggles to search for a nonviolent alternative that culminated successfully from their perspective in being included in the second peace laboratory along with a couple of other regions in Colombia. The long-term outlook for these 23 municipalities possibilities of actually achieving a long-lasting peace, economic development, locally fortified institutions of governance, and democratic participation are frankly limited. I wish I could be more optimistic. Let me give a little bit of a kind of overview of what the Peace Laboratory set out to do. There are two different types of peace and development projects. One of them was solely sponsored by the Colombian government, and those existed already in the 1990s. The very earliest one to sort of have official recognition was the one in the Magdalena Medio, which will also be the first peace laboratory. So in 1995, they developed social activists from the area, the Catholic Church Diocese, women's groups, the participation of civic organizations and elected officials, begin to move towards adopting and establishing a program to promote peaceful development in the region. In 2002, the Magdalena Medio will be adopted as the first peace laboratory. And the peace laboratories are supported by the European Union and the Colombian government, with financing through the World Bank. And they have three sort of themes that they or objectives that they hope to promote in areas of severe conflict. The first is to create projects of economic development that can provide alternatives and opportunities for individuals in those areas, either to entice them away from the production of illicit cultivation, for instance, like coca, but also because these were areas that historically, for a variety of reasons, tended to be very rich in resources, often energy resources, whether it was oil and gas or hydroelectric power in the case of the Oriente Antioqueño, the case that I studied. Or where there were mines, for instance, or the possibilities for extensive capital production of export commodities, whether it's cacao or African palm or any variety of other goods. Extensive cattle ranching typically also, but a variety of sort of very valuable resources, combined with relatively high levels of poverty. That is, you had very rich regions in terms of their resources, but relatively low employment and a very high rate of malnutrition and low social indicators for the populations that inhabited those regions. They were also typically areas that shared the characteristic of being strategically very important, either because they were located in areas that were heavily contested for the transportation of illicit goods and arms, or because, as in the case of the Oriente Antioqueño, the Autopista Medellín-Bogotá, which is the main highway that connects Medellín, the capital of Antioquia, with Bogotá, the capital of Colombia, and then through a trunk route all the way out to the Caribbean coast, traverses the entire area. So controlling transportation and the movement of goods and people across that area was of critical importance variety of armed groups and to the state. So all of these features, severe conflict, humanitarian emergencies, valuable resources, a relatively limited, sometimes absent presence of the state were the characteristics that tended to be typical of the regions, the six regions that have formed part of these peace laboratories. So in moving in to develop economic, to promote economic development, the idea was to try to address some of the inequalities that had were understood as forming the basis also for some of the conflict in those regions. That is, that it wasn't just that those armed groups weren't just there out of nowhere, but that in fact there were longstanding latent conflicts, struggles over resources and territory and land and opportunities that also fed the intensity of conflict in those areas. The second objective was to promote democratic participation. And this is very interesting because of the 18 regions that had peace and development programs, only six of them are peace laboratories. The other 12 are solely supported by the Colombian government. And if you look at the language that's used to justify and describe what the objectives are of these two peace and development projects, it's only the one that is characterized as a peace laboratory that is supported by European Union and the Colombian government that explicitly states that its objective is to create democratic governance and promote participation. In the other, that is in the Colombian Fed one, it is to relocate and support mechanisms for returning to areas for people who have been displaced and to promote some economic development in that region. But there's no allusion, no explicit allusion to actually promoting democracy or participation. And I'm going to briefly say why I think this is quite important and why this has been the area that has perhaps been the least satisfying, even as some of the economic development projects have actually been quite successful in these regions. And then a third objective was to create the basis for achieving a dignified life, the minimum requirements for a dignified life, that is, the respect for human rights, the attention to human rights law, international human rights law, and to ensuring that people would be able to, and this is linked to the idea of democratic participation, freely be able to express dissent or different opinions without necessarily incurring a violent response in reaction to that. I think this is a good moment, 7 years after the establishment of the Peace Laboratory in the Magdalena Medio, about 5 years after the initiation of the Peace Laboratory in the Oriente Antioqueño, to step back and assess how well these three objectives have been met under the Peace Laboratories. And I'm going to take them just very briefly, one by one. Economically, it's a mixed bag. There definitely have been projects that have promoted the well-being, particularly of women and youth groups in certain areas, and that have been tremendously successful, so that you can move from a soup kitchen that initially only had 11 single female heads of households to feeding 116 families. That's not an insignificant achievement. And there are similar kinds of processes that have occurred. The creation of workshops, artisanal production, for instance. Many of them are single female headed households because their men were either displaced or they were murdered. And so you have the problem not only of building peace in a time of war, which is one of the unique characteristics of the Colombian case. It's not a conflict that has ended. It's a conflict that's ongoing, but also one in which in many of these municipalities, the men are notably absent. They were killed, they were eliminated, or they left the region and for fear of what the consequences might be, have not returned. This is, again, where we might modify this success of these economic development projects. One of the crucial concerns has been to create the economic basis to entice people to return to municipalities. And in the case of the Oriente Antioqueño, there were municipalities that had lost up to 50% of their population. It's hard to actually visualize that. Places like Granada, for instance, have been unsuccessful in having those people return for very good reasons, because despite the fact that they are now part of a peace laboratory, it hasn't changed the fact that the paramilitaries, although no longer as overtly present in armed engagement as they might have been before, are nonetheless a very palpable presence that continues to have a very real influence over both elected officials and over the determination of contracts and bidding and the establishment of who can access and who cannot the territory. So if you're a marked person, you can't really return to these places, despite the insistence of the Colombian government that these areas have been pacified and that it's now safe to be able to go back there. The other area that I think has been very successful and is linked to, is part of the economic development project, but is linked more to the participation, is the development of community radios. This is an area that is particularly interesting to me because I'm in the midst of writing a book about the impact of radio in Colombia, not just in this period, but from the 1930s to the 1960s. And it's really astonishing to see how issues of creating a public forum, a space in which it is possible for individuals who have historically not had a mechanism of expression. And there was one quote by a leader in one area, actually of the Magdalena Medio, speaking about the community radios, in which I thought this was kind of an amazing statement, where he said, unless you can broadcast your voice, you don't exist. Individuals who are not recognized and don't have access to the mass media might as well be invisible, might as well not exist. And if the only news is the news that is promoted by national broadcast or international broadcasting stations, it creates stereotypes, for instance, that or sort of circumstances that local people can't possibly live up to because they don't have those kinds of conditions. So this gives them the opportunity not only to work through, for instance, sources of discontent or dispute in the community, and youth have been particularly successful at doing this, that is, of actually opening forums. It's kind of astonishing in the Oriente, these 19-year-olds, in which they invite former paramilitaries, former guerrillas, their victims, to come to the studios and actually, in a kind of neutral zone, begin to discuss and try to discover their mutual humanity. One doesn't want to over-exaggerate or romanticize, but it's been actually a tremendously effective way of getting news out to communities, of creating awareness, for instance, and integrating individuals and creating leadership, which is one of the crucial problems with the peace laboratories. One of the criteria for establishing peace laboratories, where there were two, one, they were the areas of most severe conflict, but they also had to have pre-existing existing collective organizations that were locally generated, that is, a foundation of civil society. The idea, at least theoretically, was that this would not be imposed from above, but rather that it had to be generated locally. There already had to exist organizations and local leadership and activism, and it would build on that and fortify it and extend it, but not create it, because it would be too difficult to create that. Impossible, really, and much less in an existing and ongoing condition of conflict. The community radios have really promoted that objective very effectively. But one of the sort of downsides of this is that it has also increased the ability to sort of identify particular individuals in some of these communities with certain kinds of opinions or perspectives, and makes it much easier to target them. It's one of the paradoxical sort of effects of this. But the other criteria that the Peace Laboratories had was that not all places, no matter how severe the violence might be, had the wherewithal to be selected for these laboratories, and that participation was going to be the very key, that these were communities that had already given evidence, either because they had organized asambleas abiertas or comunitarias, open community assemblies in the 1990s and 2000 to discuss, to invite opinions from the community, who had practiced transparency, inclusion, particularly by certain elected officials, and that it would, the idea was to build on that and to extend it. Unfortunately, and here's where the Peace Laboratories, of course, like everything else in Colombia or any place in the world, don't exist in a vacuum. They don't control, for instance, who gets elected to office. The Peace Laboratories exist side by side with a continuing, very important para-political force in Colombia, so that the individuals who may influence who gets elected or in how bids are determined or contracts or policies are made at the local level, and who make it very clear that they do not welcome this open dissent, are still very much in evidence, even if they exert that authority or that influence in more low-profile kinds of ways than they might have before the establishment of the Peace Laboratories. It's at this level, the participation level, that I feel the least optimistic, sadly. And it actually pains me quite a bit, because these were communities who, in the midst of what from my perspective anyway, was almost an unbearable humanitarian crisis, nonetheless insisted on convoking individuals, on including the community, on discussing alternatives, on taking very significant risks in order to establish mechanisms or channels of dialogue with the various armed actors, sometimes even risking being marginalized or repudiated by either the central government or the regional government at certain moments in time, that is, these local governments. And so while these economic development projects have, I think, developed and emerged apace, the cost seems to have been that participation has gone by the wayside. That one of the sort of expectations is that as people's economic condition improves, the need to give expression to dissent or different opinions or to have freedom of expression should be a value that is worth exchanging for the right to be able to generate economic opportunity. And I find this deeply problematic. And finally, one other piece of the Peace Laboratories, and this is something that has been raised by observers in Europe and social activists as well, is that there is a way in which, by combining the strategy, as has occurred in Colombia, of securing territories militarily with the complement of the Peace Laboratories providing social and economic investment, whether intentionally or not, indirectly, civilians can, the whole distinction between combatant and non-combatant can blur. The whole civilian populations can actually be opened up to risk in certain areas. And they're forced to sort of take a position. They're asked to incorporate themselves and assist, for instance, the Colombian government if they want to have access to some of the projects or opportunities that are provided by the Peace Laboratories. because the actors who made their lives unbearable and unlivable still exist, right? Those haven't disappeared. That's the whole dilemma, I think, that this book so well grapples with, and that is, how do you manage these kinds of peace initiatives in a situation of ongoing conflict in which the various actors who have made that conflict possible may have abated in certain areas, may be marginalized to some degree, may have reorganized or restructured, but have not disappeared. And they continue to exert a certain amount of control and influence in very palpable ways on the lives of the individuals, even those lucky enough to have been included in something like the Peace Laboratories.
First, I want to congratulate very much Ginny Bouvier and USIP for putting this book together. I really hope it makes a huge impact on how people understand the necessity to retake up the agenda for peace in Colombia, and the fact that the tools exist and that the analytical tools exist. And I congratulate you and everybody at the Institute who worked on it. It fills a huge vacuum. My chapter that Jorge Rojas and I wrote focused on the role of Colombian civil society, which played a really key role in getting the 1998 to 2002 peace process started up. Unfortunately, the chapter concludes that by the middle of the 2000s, the civil society peace movement had lost a lot of influence. It was itself internally divided, and it was confronting a very pro-war consensus, both in Colombia and as well as in the United States. But despite its weakened condition, we concluded that the civil society peace movement was probably still the best hope as a channel or as a way of opening the door to getting back to dialogues eventually. But I'm not really going to talk about that. Ginny has suggested that I speak about what's next for U.S. policy and how U.S. policy could be better supporting peace in Colombia right now. And I'll try to get to that. It's not an easy one. First of all, the context that in which U.S. policy is playing out is one that is not all that favorable toward peace right now. Neither the Colombian government nor the guerrilla groups are falling over themselves to get back to the negotiating table, you might have noticed. In the case of the ELN, there's not much even to say right now. The talks of the ELN are in a state of disarray. The last talks in Cuba happened in the middle of 2007. There does not seem to be anything even closely resembling a consensus within the group's leadership about getting back to the table, although some more recent comments from Gabino, the head of the ELN, may indicate at least that they remain open, although for now they may be just trying to wait out President Uribe. Militarily, the ELN are weak, but not out of the game, and in fact may be slightly increasing their activity in places like Arauca, Bolívar, and Nariño, certainly getting more involved in narco-trafficking, which is making them stronger because of the money associated with it. As we wrote in the book, though, the main avenue right now offering hope for getting the ELN, pulling them, drawing them into the dialogues, is an effort called Colombianos y Colombianas por la Paz, led by Senator Piedad Córdoba and other civil society leaders who have been engaged in an exchange of open letters with the leaders of both guerrilla movements. They've been writing back and forth with the ELN, starting out with a demand that both groups release all of the kidnapped people who they're holding for ransom or as hostages. In the case of the FARC, as Mark said, they're under new management, and that management is from the traditionally considered the more political or intellectual wing of the guerrillas, which doesn't necessarily bode well for peace, at least not in the short term. The political wing has to win over the military wing of the FARC by showing that they're just as tough in the battlefield and just as willing to go after the Colombian government as before. Also, after several years of messages saying that the guerrillas are on the ropes, almost beaten, the FARC are feeling a lot of pressure to show that no, they're not, and they're carrying out a lot of activities. There has been in 2009. First of all, you notice that since Operación Jaque, when they released the amazing hostage release liberation effort back in July of 2008, since then there haven't been a lot of major steps against the FARC. There was the defeat of a FARC offensive in the Sumapaz region south of Bogota in March, in which a couple of top guerrilla leaders, local guerrilla leaders, were killed. But for the most part, it's been a bit stagnant. And in fact, during 2009, we've seen an increase in FARC ambushes, landmine attacks, efforts to recruit, and attacks on local civilian leaders, mayors, councilmen, many more threats, and in some cases mayors and councilmen and others being forced to govern from elsewhere, as happened in 2002. Not a major increase yet, but enough to worry us. And that is certainly part of that, and as we've heard from FARC members who have briefly kidnapped local leaders recently, part of the reason they're doing this is to show President Uribe that they're not beaten. No, actually, right now, you could certainly argue that the FARC are not even Colombia's main security concern. The former paramilitary groups who have regrouped and are remobilizing and are growing quite quickly, even though perhaps maybe 20 or 30% of their membership used to be old AUC paramilitaries. They've got a lot of new members. They've morphed with the drug trafficking organizations and are fighting each other, especially since last May when 15 of the top paramilitary leaders were extradited here to the United States. That opened up a lot of ground for, you know, the Leviathan was gone, and all of the right-hand men and middle management paramilitary leaders are now fighting each other for control over corridors and routes and control of populations. Santa Fe de Ralito, which was the sort of uncontested dominion of the paramilitaries, which is the place where the talks with the paramilitaries and the Colombian government happened from 2002 to 2005. Ralito is now one of the most dangerous places in Colombia. The police are afraid to leave their police station. I heard from community leaders there recently. It's as dangerous as La Macarena in the south because of the fighting between these groups. So, and you're seeing an increase in urban crime and especially urban murder rates as a result of the war ongoing between the paramilitary leaders for control of criminality. Okay, but that back to the FARC. I mean, the FARC, in the midst of that, are also trying to show that they remain political and that they're not just narcos. They're doing that, unfortunately, by increasing targeting of political figures, especially in local areas. Within that context, in which I'm not being very hopeful, your best hope, again, is a civil society effort. This is the Colombianos y Colombianas por la Paz, who have exchanged several letters now with the FARC since their first one in, I believe it was September of last year. They are working to convince the FARC to release all of the hostages. Some of the leaders of that movement are convinced that at some point in the medium term, they'll actually get a commitment from Alfonso Cano and the FARC leadership to stop kidnapping and to release the kidnapped victims that they have. That would be a major, major confidence-building move toward getting something towards dialogue on track. But we'll have to wait and see if it happens. The next step, and it's been the next step for a couple months now, would be the release of Corporal Moncayo, a FARC hostage since 1998. Sorry, whose the circumstances of whose release have been the subject of a really sort of depressing match of how the logistics of it would happen and who would be on the committee to receive Moncayo when the FARC release him unilaterally, as they promised to do. Our President Uribe had refused to allow one of the leaders of Colombianos por la Paz, Senator Cordoba, to be on the committee to come pick him up. Just last week, President Uribe relented on that and agreed that Piedad Cordoba could come along and go pick him up. So now that ball is back in the FARC's court, and we hope that that release happens soon, even if it does not generate much confidence, as a lot of their previous unilateral releases have not. I mean, President Uribe, obviously his heart is not in pursuing a new peace dialogue. His platform since the very beginning has been weakening them on the battlefield. Reversing, however, he does deserve praise for his occasional moves to get at least get peace, show that he's open to peace, let's put it that way. Reversing his position on Senator Cordoba is one. Another is a proposal he made several months ago for a 40-day cease of hostilities. He should be more clear on that is a bilateral cease of hostilities, although it may seem obvious the FARC didn't see it that way. But if he is serious about that proposal, which is not a bad proposal, a cease of hostilities while the sides actually make arrangements and sit down and choose interlocutors and have a conversation about how to get to the table, that's not a bad proposal, but he has not gone and made it again. He has to actually make it several times and make clear that this is something that he is willing to make the necessary political risks to carry out. But it's sort of a proposal he floated out there and nobody really nibbled on the line and it just sort of died. That should be brought up again. Both sides, to get the talks restarted, need sort of a mutually agreed interlocutor, somebody who can play the good offices role that the UN was designed to play, the UN Secretary General's representative was designed to play in the late 90s and early 2000s. It could be the UN, it could be the church, it could be, I don't know, Bill Richardson, it could be, and Eric, probably can't be Hugo Chavez at this point. It has to be somebody who is agreed on both by both sides to the conflict, who can actually play that key role of getting communications going quietly, out of the public eye, not in, you know, open angry letters or editorials or statements to reporters, but actually getting the logistics and the staff work done that you would need to actually begin a conversation again. An interlocutor is crucial. Right now, I mean, you've got a situation where though Uribe is certainly not moving strongly toward peace, the ball is mainly in the FARC's court. They have to release Moncayo. They have to respond to the call from Colombianos por la Paz to release the hostages, yes or no, what's it going to be? They have to respond clearly to Uribe's offer of a cease of hostilities, and I think that's pretty unlikely for the time being. You've got elections pending, and you've got a re-election debate pending. You've got the FARC show with a strong desire to show their military abilities, and also their inclination is maybe just to wait out Uribe and see who comes next. As far as the elections go, also, we'll see whether the FARC ends up, inadvertently making sure Alvaro Uribe gets reelected again. All they need is another, outrageous act, or the kidnapping or massacring of somebody who's well known and well loved in Colombia, or something like that, and everyone will be outraged, and the FARC will have elected Uribe again. Perhaps Alfonso Cano will play it smarter. We don't know. So in that context, which I just spent way too much time discussing, the challenges for U.S. policy are hard, because right now here domestically, you've all noticed, there's reduced interest in Colombia compared to, say, 6 or 7 or 8 years ago. We have a new administration that has actually avoided discussing Colombia for the most part. There's a desire to expand relations with other regional leaders in the hemisphere, Brazil, Mexico, Chile. We're also up against years now of being told how much better everything is in Colombia, and how they're at the beginning of the end, and how that the problems of Colombia are now manageable, that the strategy worked, and so hey, why stay engaged when there's so many other things to worry about in the world? After 10 years of aid, $6.8 billion, more than three quarters of it military aid, there's a strong desire here in Washington to sort of just hope the light is at the end of the tunnel, which has led to pressure for Colombianization, for Colombia to take up much more of the costs of what we were paying for, and just to sort of generalize Colombia fatigue. You get on the phone to somebody in Capitol Hill wanting to talk about Colombia, and you wait out the sigh, the world-weary sigh, and then get on with the conversation. And, of course, here in Washington, there are mounting concerns about the government we're dealing with, especially about President Uribe. He's beset by these big three scandals, parapolitics, falsos positivos, the DAS wiretappings and surveillance, which are taking a toll on his image here, as is his continuous flirtations with running for a third term. The result of all this, you're in a context of less aid for Colombia. The aid request for 2010 is $32 million less than it was for 2009, which was about $50 million less than it was for 2008. And that aid is becoming less militarized. There's less interest in the security end, or less desire to pump it all into the security end, which I praise, and more of an effort to try to build up institutions and create economic opportunity. You've got a situation where the free trade agreement is on hold, and where in the overall relationship between the two presidents and between the two governments, 5 days before George Bush left office, he gave President Uribe the Medal of Freedom. Nobody's giving Colombia any medals right now. So there's sort of, at least as far as where to go with Colombia and where, on trade and on just sort of the overall relationship with Uribe, there's probably not much of an emerging consensus right now. And there's a sense that we just have to wait for now. See if Uribe is going to stay. And see how they deal with these scandals. There is what appears to be an emerging consensus between the administration and Congress on what aid is going to look like over the next few years. They're moving towards something called integrated action, which is sort of like a fit. They've basically, with the Colombian government, with U.S. assistance, has selected about 13 regions of the country, sort of like the peace laboratories, but with a huge military and government component, where they're going to consolidate state control over the territory by basically bringing the government into areas that have never really had a government presence before. It's a little bit state building, and it's a lot counterinsurgency. Theoretically, it's supposed to be a mostly non-military effort. Phase one, yeah, you bring in the military because you need security, and then phase two, phase three, you start bringing in all the other institutions of the government, and eventually your end state is that you have civilians, providing most of the services. That's hardly the case so far in any of the 13 zones. The two zones that the United States is really heavily funding right now are La Macarena and Montes de Maria. This is probably an improvement over over Plan Colombia because, you know, it's not just focused on going after drugs or going after guerrillas. It's going after state weakness, and it's going, hopefully, we'll be going after the problem of rampant impunity as well. And, you know, the stated goal of helping the Colombian government protect its citizens and provide basic services is laudable. It's much better than we're just going to increase the number of hectares we spray with herbicides. But it remains to be seen. As Mary had just mentioned, some of the risks about the lines blurring between non-combatant and combatant. You have another risk of the military just doing everything. I just had the colonel in Montes de Maria tell me last week that his vision is that the military, after a peace agreement is signed, will be the country's main road builder. You'll have the other element of the civilians just failing to pick up their end and disappointing the population, or even the civilians being the same corrupt, paramilitary-penetrated elites that you're seeing in a lot of the regions, you know, being included in these programs, which would do more harm than good. Or, of course, the constant risk that, you know, if these programs will put the security forces in constant contact with the population, and if they abuse that population with impunity, you're going to make things worse as well. Despite that, those concerns, those are more operational concerns than the core concept concern. You don't really have to make too many fundamental changes to your strategy document, but how that strategy gets played out is important. Democrats in Congress, for the most part, aren't rejecting that model outright, as most of the Democrats, particularly in the House, did with Plan Colombia. But there will be a lot of suggested adjustments rather than rethinking, so that it moves away from being just a counterinsurgency program, something more like a state-building program, with the United States really just contributing in a few areas, mainly because of shrinking resources. But ultimately, if we really go into this program seriously of moving the state in and making economic well-being a key priority, you're going to bump right up in rural areas against the issue of land in Colombia, which is crucial to any peace settlement, but is horribly complicated, involves a lot of powerful interests, and will take a lot of political will to move forward. What this new direction of USAID really does lack is a clear peace strategy. It sort of assumes that the guerrillas will always be there on the fringes of these areas where we're focused, and that you're just gradually expanding the area under state control and consolidating. But how to get from that sort of, you know, expanding oil spot of state control to actual peace dialogues, you know, what would, you know, what you need to bring the definitive end to these guerrilla insurgencies in a peaceful way, not at all clear how you're going to do that. The United States should be helping to add on a peace strategy to this, and also to bring peace more into the political discussion in Colombia. In its relations with President Uribe and or his successors, I think that the United States, this new administration, should be making clear that if that administration is willing to make politically risky moves in favor of getting back on track toward peace, including, you know, the discussion of a dialogue that involves more than just surrender terms, then, you know, that they'll have political cover from the United States, that we will back them on that and make it an easier thing for them to do domestically. Any discussion of peace is going to involve a strong debate internally in Colombia between moderates and hardliners, including the security forces, and it involves, you know, clearly taking the sides of the moderates in those discussions as appropriate. I think the United States' ability to prod the FARC toward dialogues is pretty minimal right now. There's no hope of contact, and the main way we confront them is on the battlefield, hopefully not increasingly. Another thing the United States should be doing is, and it's not expensive, is just more stronger accompaniment, clearer accompaniment of people who are working for peace in Colombia. That includes civil society leaders who are working at great risks to themselves, as well as people within government who hold views or are pushing for policy options that may not enjoy a consensus within the current Colombian government. We need to be backing them and in some cases ensuring their safety, keeping them alive, and also just through our own messages helping to make them credible. And finally, the United States should be helping more energetically in the search for an interlocutor who is and backing the eventual choice who can actually get messages and proposals between the two sides in this. If whoever enjoys U.S. backing will have a much greater possibility of success And that is an initiative that is, you know, behind the scenes and quiet, but where the United States could play a decisive role. And after 18 minutes, I'll leave it there. Thank you very much.
I'm going to resist the temptation to ask my own questions. but those who would like to raise questions, I suggest you line up behind these two mics, and then the panel will, I'm sure, be happy to respond. If there's any hesitation, then I'll be happy to suggest some. Please.
Okay, my name is Christos Kiro, and I'm working at American University. I'm a professor, and I'm focusing on capacities for negotiations and of insurgents. And one of the things we've seen historically, the most successful transformations to peace from insurgents have been the transformation of the insurgents into a political party. And the ambition has been there in FARC since its beginning. We had the Patriotic Union that was demolished. We had the Bolivarian Party of Alfonso Cano when he wasn't even the leader of the insurgency. He was under Marulanda, but yet he pushed for the Bolivarian Party. It looks like the man has ambition to run for office, and that if he ran for office, he may take his 5%, and we're going to be done with FARC by then. And we've seen the ANC, the FMLN in South Africa, the FMLN in Salvador. We've seen the Maoists in Nepal. Every time we had elections, we had pretty much a smooth transformation towards resolution. I must say that this is the first time that I see this fresh air of approach to that conflict. I actually have a reason why I was sitting next to the door, because I was afraid I was going to listen to the same stuff I've been listening the last few days with President Uribe's visit, and I would have to run out the door pretty fast.
The question is,
we have a doctrinal condition in conflict resolution, that for the parties to negotiate, most likely, especially in an insurgency, they have to realize that they cannot win, that they are in a position where there is no way out through victory. We saw this in Northern Ireland, we saw this in South Africa, and so on. And here we have the FARC negotiating with, by the way, with the ALN to create a unified front, attacking constantly and increasing their attacks against the government. What other ways can President Uribe realize that he cannot win this war? Because they bring Peru as an example. If you talk with people, you know, in the government, and they say Peru won. Peru has not won. The Sendero Luminoso is back and strong, and with new logistics too. So what does it take for Uribe's government to position himself into the realization he cannot win that war, and he has to push for everything else to happen?
Let's have the panel respond.
I'll take a shot at that. The operating theory in conflict resolution it usually is mutually hurting stalemate, right, that William Zartman came up with. And if you say that, mutually hurting stalemate, that's when the conditions are ripe for negotiations. Well, in Colombia, there's no mutually hurting stalemate. Neither the FARC nor the government are at that point. Now, the problem with that concept is civil society is hurting. The population, the IDPs are hurting. But that hurt doesn't reflect into the object. And so I think discard the concept. If we wait for a mutually hurting stalemate, we'll be here a long time. We've been here a long time. And so I'd say discard the conflict. Look for a way for peace. The way Uribe's tone changed, and you can actually see it up till Operation Haki a year ago and afterwards. Up until about a year ago, they were saying, we're going to increase our leverage at the battlefield and impose a negotiated settlement.
Right.
And then now they've been going, we're going to go all the way. I think the pressure has to come from below, from civil society, just what the rest of the panel said, and from the international community on the outside. We need to make clear that peace is the only option. The status quo, that is violence and relative stability at the core, which is the history of Colombia for 60 years, is possible. This could go on a very long time more. But if it's going to change, it's going to be from below, those groups that hurt, who are hurting but not are the actors who have to mutually hurt. They need to make their voice heard and needs to be echoed at the international level to push the others forward. I'm hoping a new president could do that.
Okay. Anyone else? Ginny?
I would just add that the international community can play a role here, because part of the issue is, I think that the costs exist, but they're invisibilized, if that's a word. Companies that go into Colombia expect to pay heavy security to do their business in Colombia. I think to the extent that it can be clear that those costs are now unacceptable, that the central government needs to come up with a plan to have peace in Colombia as part of the negotiating with incoming investors, I think that that could be helpful. You know, I think the other question I would say is that for a long time, the military effort was to weaken the FARC and to bring them to the peace table. And I think that the weakening of the FARC has taken place, and it's time to kind of put the feet to the fire and say, well, they're weakened. The next step is the peace table. I think there's really not been a line in the sand drawn to say this is the point at which they're weakened enough that we're going to stop pushing militarily and we're going to create a space for the negotiations to take place. So I think this is actually a good time to think about negotiations. It's not what we would call a ripe moment, but I think that the conflict resolution literature also shows that ripe moments are really determined in hindsight after the negotiations have taken place. You go back and say, well, yes, it was ripe and everybody was ready to sit down. So in some ways, it's kind of arbitrary to say when the time is ripe or not ripe. I think what civil society can do is to highlight what the costs are of the war, what the costs are to the civilian population, what the costs are in the rural areas, what the costs are to investors and to the business community, because they too are paying a lot of expenses, even though I think it's kind of been naturalized and they've come to expect that these are just the costs of doing business in Colombia. They don't have to be the costs of doing business in Colombia.
I would only add one thing, which is if there was a disappointment that was expressed by some of the individuals with the Peace Laboratory, it was that they had an expectation that the entrance of the European community would also be accompanied by a greater willingness to denounce, to make explicit and public the continued violation of human rights. And that hasn't happened to the degree that people, I think, had hoped it would. It's so that, you know, they play the role almost of a witness for peace, except at a regional and local level and not an individual level, the notion that it would provide a certain level of neutrality and create a space in which it was possible for civil society to put the pressure and make these kinds of issues much more public and open and pressure. But it hasn't happened.
Well, I would just, on the issue of whether you're going to win or not, and finally getting your mind around the fact that you're not going to win, the FARC in the past seemed to have addressed negotiations as within the framework of the combination of forms of struggle. If you ask somebody in the FARC, and we did, during the last peace process, you know, what do you want to get out of this? Their answer was simple. We want power. We'll try to get power by the military means, and we'll also try to get it through the negotiated means. And you know, probably the last 6 years has made clear that 7 years, that they're probably not going to get power that way. So they're going to have to redefine what they mean by winning. Winning could mean, you know, certainly getting more than just, you know, an amnesty when they demobilize it. Hopefully for them, it would, you know, it could mean something like dealing with the land issue and actually getting a fundamental land reform, for example. But, you know, actual arriving in power, I'm afraid they're going to have to let go of that.
Good afternoon. My name is George Laws Garcia. I'm a master's student at American University. Thank you all for being here for this excellent panel presentation, for the amazing book. I wanted to ask about what do you see are the possibilities for Colombia's civil society peace movement to rebuild the broad-based coalition that they had during the end of the Samper administration, leading up to the Pastrana administration, that really pushed for the peace negotiations to become a chief political element in that campaign, seeing as the Uribe's third term is an undetermined thing, and there's possibility of political change there. What would it take for the civil society peace movement to rebuild that broad base and put peace and negotiations back on the political agenda as one of the main things for that presidential election?
Panel? Whoever wants to start on it?
Start with
Mary?
Since I did the civil society chapter.
Did the civil society.
A big challenge there for civil society is what you have left of people who would consider themselves, you know, full-time or, you know, much of their time peace activists in Colombia right now are people from the left, people from the university sectors, people from the labor sectors, or from, you know, with ties to the left opposition. They've got to grow beyond that. One of the big power or the big strength that the peace movement had in 1997-98 was that, yeah, it included a lot of the old lefties and people who led the 1990-91 peace and constitutional reform efforts and who really had an idealistic vision. But they brought in, you know, they brought in the Chambers of Commerce, they brought in Francisco Santos and, you know, the traditional media elites and a lot of the political class and parts of the church hierarchy who by 2000 had pretty much split off. And by 2001, we're just not even talking to them anymore. So how do you build that big tent coalition again? There's probably, you know, just writing down while you're asking the question, there's probably two things that are completely outside their control and one that is. The one that is simply the ideological question. I mean, how are you defining peace? Are you going to think this is, you know, that peace equals the rethinking of the Colombian polity? Or is it just... you know, arriving at a set of reforms that are enough to get, you know, the armed conflict ended. If it's the former, obviously you're not going to build a big tent then, because rebuilding the Colombian polity is going to go against the interest of a lot of those people you need in a big tent to get the mainstream of society behind you. If it's the latter, hey, maybe. But that is a discussion that certainly there's no consensus on within the peace movement right now. And two things outside their control. Another thing that would be a big boost is simply if Uribe's democratic security strategy runs into a wall, you know, just starts really showing reversed, you know, shows that it's run its course, that the military strategy has done all it can, and that, well, actually, as we've seen in the last 12 months, that violence statistics start going the wrong way and that the armed groups are doing more on the battlefield. If that trend, the trend line of the last 8 or 9 months continues or accelerates, then, yeah, maybe there will be more public opinion in favor of peace. Of a negotiated peace. And finally, another thing that's largely outside their control, although they can certainly help to attract it, is external support. Just what Mark was saying about the international community's open support and participation and political cover and even financing and physical protection when necessary.
Mark? Let me just add very quickly. There's a few things that can help. One is that right now, peace activists and human rights defenders are stigmatized, and they're stigmatized almost weekly from the president on down. And it's very difficult to have a human rights program and human rights agenda and a peace agenda when you're stigmatized as being a terrorist. And that has to stop, and that's something that the U.S. government should, they quietly whisper into the ear of President Uribe, don't do that, but they need to do that more forcefully. And the same thing, these spurious lawsuits against peace activists like Piedad Córdoba and human rights defenders. You need to open that space, and the pressure has to be made to open the space. And I'll simply add, despite the pessimistic scenario, there have been interesting rumblings. One is the Catholic Church. The new head of the Episcopal Conference has moved the church straight into this idea of the church has to be re-engaged actively with negotiations and peace, with a negotiated settlement. That's very important. And you're hearing elements from the business community echoing some of this. So that there are the basis for some of these things to come together. And opening that space will be very important.
Could I just add, I mean, the head of the Bishops' Conference, it wasn't merely that it's time to begin a process leading to peace negotiations, but that the church wants to have direct contact with the Secretariat of the FARC with respect to an agenda and mechanisms to move the process forward. That is new.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
And If I could just, the one other thing it seems to me is that everybody has talked in some way about new leadership on the FARC, new leadership in the United States, although it hasn't quite happened yet in the sense that the full range of policymaking within the U.S. government with respect to Latin America is not yet there. And so there is an opportunity, perhaps, as this takes place, for new thinking to be put forward at a time, perhaps, that there's also change taking place in Colombia with respect to the need to move away from a failed policy so far as ending the conflict is concerned, and to some degree a failed policy on drugs as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hi, Liz Harper from USIP. Thank you all so much for coming and being here today. My question is about what President Uribe said during his speech at the Wilson Center a couple weeks ago. Basically, he argued that passing the free trade agreement would boost stability, economic security, and then stability in the country. Do you all buy that argument?
Be my guest.
Well, Adam's the authority in this.
I'm really not.
Pass the economic fund.
I'm the military aid guy. speaking as a complete non-economist, I would say that FTAs probably, the FTA may indeed create a net increase in employment in Colombia. A lot of those jobs will not be great jobs. They'll be not unionized jobs. They'll be, you know, in some rather difficult sectors of the economy to work in. But there will probably be a net increase in jobs. That said, FTAs also deal brutal shocks. They have winners and losers. And when you know, a lot of the losers may be people who live in the areas of the country that are most conflicted, particularly small family farmers. Now, I'm not an economist, and I don't know anywhere in the world right now where the family farm model is particularly doing well. But the FTA, as it's currently designed, as most people have explained it to me, will be a boon for people who have large land holdings and crops that take several years on which you have to live off your own liquidity before you can even start harvesting them. I'm talking cacao, timber, African palm, biofuels, other biofuel crops. Whereas if you grow corn or rice and you're on, you know, which are general, or other crops that you usually have to harvest right away because you can't live off anything else, and you have a small amount of land, you may find yourself losing out, at least in the short term. And unfortunately in Colombia, in the areas where those people would be, there's another crop that they can grow, and all you need is 20 or 30,000 families across Colombia to switch to coca as a result of being wiped out to see a huge increase in coca growing in Colombia. And there are also people who are, you know, offering employment to unemployed rural dwelling young people, and that's the guerrillas and the paramilitaries. And I'm not convinced that the FTA in its current design has enough safeguards in place to cushion the shock on the losers in rural areas. Speaking not as an economist.
Yeah, no, right. And this is the argument of most Colombian peace activists, is that the FTA is likely to cause hardship in precisely the areas of conflict. And so it's likely to exacerbate the conflict, and that ought to be considered. Mm-hmm. And two, and this is also very important, although I guess the economists argue it slightly differently. Right now, Colombian products enter the United States tariff-free. There's a one-way free trade agreement where Colombia gets the advantages of export, and they don't get the disadvantages of forcing their economy to adjust to imports. That model is probably a good one in the short term until we get to a more stable situation of peace.
Hi, I'm Catherine Hughes-Freytek with Peace Brigades International. Ooh. And we actually have four major teams in Colombia, so we're doing a lot of work internally. It's interesting to hear the word accompaniment. We do what we call protective accompaniment and work with human rights defenders there. Basically, my question is kind of building on what was just asked, which is the sense that our experience has been that to have a real peace, a sustainable peace, which you've talked about, you need a peace with justice. You need this justice peace. And you've talked a lot about what the different groups involved are calling for. Key piece is agrarian land reform. That's been an issue for a long time, as well as democratic participation issues. So my question is, even though I understand the importance, and it's very important internally, the groups that are acting, civilian society, civil society, the government, et cetera, I think also historically the whole external community and international community and the various interests that play out economically, militarily, politically, et cetera, trade regimes are really important too to either reinforce peace in an area or to break it apart. and to play powers off of each other and the various players. So maybe just a little comment. I've heard pieces of it, and there may be more in the book. I haven't had a chance to look at it yet, but a sense of how the international community has either supported or not, or can support or not. Again, corporate interests may not be supportive of land reform, and so there may be some interests there that don't want to see that go through in a lot of ways.
Can I take a stab at this? I think that part of the problem is assuming that there's a kind of homogeneity out there in the international community, mm-hmm. or a consensus, and of course there isn't, just as there isn't within Colombia itself. And I'll give a classic example. Both Ecopetrol in the Magdalena Medio region and Isagen, which is a large electricity producer and transporter in Antioquia out of hydroelectric plants, are part of the problem in the areas where they operate, but they also significantly support through financial contributions and even by integrating and incorporating individuals into their sustainability and social responsibility groups, representatives from civil society. And what you have is a kind of paradox. This happens to the state as well, where individuals who wish to give expression to a point of view that may differ from the energy company. For instance, the issue of the rates that are charged to rural communities is a bone of considerable contention. In a place like Antioquia, electricity is subsidized for industrial production and urban populations. And the rural populations that produce 35% of all of the 35% of all of the electricity that's consumed in Colombia is generated in the Oriente Antioqueño, in just these municipalities out of hydroelectric power. It's enormous. And they pay double or three times the amount. So to expect international investors or even national investors who have kind of their Janus face, right? They have two to have some sort of consensus around this issue, I think, is very difficult. This is one of the questions that is raised also by the peace laboratories. A lot of what's promoted, and goes back to the agrarian, the problem of land, is monoculture, because that's what pays, right? You can export cacao. You can export African palm. President Uribe has given a big push to biofuels, for instance, as the sort of energy alternative and future for Colombia. But what's the cost of that? Peasant and subsistence producers are at a very definite disadvantage there. And so I think I'm not optimistic, but I also don't think that it's realistic to expect that there is a kind of consensus out there in the international community. And I think that there's one of the sort of criticisms or observations that's been made about the peace laboratories is that, for instance, how many of the, to what degree the desire to establish a presence in Colombia isn't also partly linked to a desire to exploit some of its resources. There are very valuable resources in these areas that have also historically been sites of conflict. And it raises a whole series of ethical dilemmas about how you balance equity and development, right?
I'll make it short because I want to hear Cindy's question. I would just add that there are a lot of ways that internationals can support justice more broadly. I'll leave it to you to look at the book. There are a number of examples of, for example, the Norwegian government looking to create spaces for dialogue between military and ex-guerrillas and really create the discussions that need to happen to prevent the spoilers from taking over and dictating the shots. So I think that validating dissent and validating the possibilities of discussion of alternate points of view is really important. I think that the space that's been created for the left legitimately within the Colombian system is a really important step forward, because it takes the rug out from under the guerrillas who would argue that there's no space for them at the table. I think the experience with the UP and the killings of the UP has left its mark, but I think that there is a space now, or at least ideally there should be a space now, for those legitimate points of view to be expressed. Now, if those the people who express those views are harassed, followed, have lawsuits against them, or attacked as being guerrilla sympathizers, it shrinks that space. And I think it gives more power to the guerrilla's argument that there's no room for them at the table. So I think that those kinds of spaces for political representation of difference and of dissent are incredibly important. And I think that internationals
can play a role in making sure that those spaces are protected. I think supporting the legitimacy of human rights workers, of unionists, of journalists, of magistrates who are trying to end impunity for violence is really important. And beyond that, I would echo what Mary had to say about the heterogeneity of the international community. There are corporations, there are NGOs working. The Peace Brigades International is doing accompaniment. I think the United Nations has, through the UNDP, and there's a section on the UNDP efforts in the book. So I think there are a lot of different ways that the international community has been helpful and has been harmful in peace efforts.
Jenny.
I'm Cindy Buell with Congressman Jim McGovern, and I do want to thank Ginny and all of you for the book. It's I'm making my way through it. It's just reminding me of how rich a history here has been lost, and I'm very glad that you're resurrecting it and projecting it into the present and future. My question is not sophisticated at all. It's, you know, people, Mark and Adam in particular, have mentioned, a political effort or a policy that puts peace in as a priority. My question is, how do we get there without confronting the paramilitaries? What needs to be done with the paramilitary situation, the current paramilitary situation, and where it's going?
I would just briefly throw that back to you, Cindy, before I let my colleagues take it up, because I think you made some remarks, or Congressman McGovern made some remarks yesterday when he was at USIP about using the potential and the power that the United States has and that the Colombian government has to go after the paramilitaries who are threatening civil society and civil society leaders, and I think that we haven't seen much action on that front. And it's the specifics of how that's done. I think there are different tools that we have in our toolkit to do that kind of thing. We've used them for going after the FARC, and I would suggest that we might consider using them for going after the paramilitaries as well.
And I would suggest you're talking about two very different phenomena. I think that if, say, in the rest of 2009, a huge peace offensive manages somehow to get the FARC to agree to demobilize, and the Secretariat turns in their weapons, and there's all kinds of ceremonies, and the FARC ceases to exist as an entity, there will still be thousands of members of the FARC, both current and former, who are out there in the drug trafficking, doing business with El Loco Barrera and Cuchillo and Don Mario's remnants and all of these, the existing paramilitary groups, and competing violently for control of drug trafficking corridors and getting arms into the country and corrupting officials. And that phenomenon will still be there. And that's a much bigger problem that probably won't be resolved at the peace table. It's a problem of Colombia needing a comprehensive organized crime strategy, at the heart of which would be a historic house cleaning, getting their influence out of the government, out of the state, and punishing anybody who collaborates with it, and having a justice system that works. That challenge is probably even more important than just finding a way to get the FARC, the Secretariat, to agree to turn their weapons in. But it's organized crime. Yeah, it's a much more holistic approach.
Well, it is, but I would say ending the political conflict is key, and that means a comprehensive peace, and it means negotiations with the FARC and ELN, but it also means another round of demobilization, repression, discussions with the paramilitaries. It can't be left out. What we've never seen in Colombia, all these years of peacemaking, is a comprehensive strategy and a comprehensive peace with all actors. And in fact, what you discuss with the ELN and the FARC is not the same thing you discuss with the remobilized paramilitaries, but they need to have that discussion. If you can solve the political conflict, then it is going to be a stronger state that can address the criminal issue. The drug trafficking, the criminal groups, that they're not going to go away overnight. But states can defeat cartels and criminal syndicates and so forth. The problem with Colombia is the mixture of political criminal. And I would say focus like a laser on all the actors comprehensively within the political conflict. Not, and demobilization is not just hand in arms, and we all understand that. Mm-hmm. But whatever the ingredients of a comprehensive peace would be, with real substantive reform, that would take us a long way. But the paramilitaries have to be inside. If we just talk with the FARC, we'll just be going around in circles again.
I think Mark's point is well taken. And I think that you have to also recognize, though, that when you talk about the paramilitary today, it's not a single group.
Yeah.
There's a significant number. I would say the bulk of what we're now calling paramilitary are, in fact, organized criminals. And that they're much more regionally located paramilitary with political objectives that one has to identify. And those are the ones that you would incorporate.
Yes.
But I think that once you have a comprehensive peace agreement, you, in fact, take off the battlefield the large majority of the organized armed groups that are seeking their political ends through the use of armed force. When you get them off, then it is an effort to get the society and the state to adopt a more effective rule of law strategy and law enforcement strategy that aims at the organized criminals. And that's what you do. And you have to know as you go into the process that this is going to be a part of the end game. That is, the post-conflict will require an organized strategy aimed at taking down these organized criminal groups.
Go ahead. My name is Laura Kaplan, and I'm a senior at Tufts University majoring in Peace and Justice Studies and International Relations, and I'm also interning at the IOM this summer. And my question concerns war crimes and crimes against humanity, and I was wondering if civil society and people who have been affected by these crimes are more concerned with establishing a sense of social peace or justice for these perpetrators who have committed crimes against them and their families, and also with regard to that, if you see a productive, renewed role of the ICC in Colombia.
We'll take the last question at the same time. We'll ask the group to.
Good afternoon. My name is Jorge Lavalle, and I'm a senior and a journalist senior in the University of Navarra in Spain, and also interning in the International Broadcasting Bureau here in Washington. And I have a question regarding the internally displaced people. And that is that when we talk about Colombia, we talk a lot about the FARC, about the guerrillas, about the war on drugs, but I feel like we don't hear a lot of numbers regarding the IDPs. And since the numbers are really huge, I mean, there have been more than 3 million displaced people in the last decades in Colombia, and it seems like Colombia is now actually the second country with the most displaced people in the world. The first one. Oh.
They passed Sudan.
They passed Sudan.
Oh, that's incredible. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I mean, in case the government of Colombia managed to put an end to the armed conflict, they will still have to deal with all those displaced people.
Mm-hmm.
So, in the situation of a post conflict, will the situation of the IDPs become the next major crisis for the government of Colombia, worse than it is now?
Ginny, you want to start?
I'll start with the second question first. I think the IDP crisis is already a major problem for the Colombian government. There was a constitutional court decree that found that the Colombian government is responsible for taking care of the issue of the internally displaced. So I think that's something that's on the table. I would just kind of think comparatively, too. I think other peace processes we're beginning to see efforts to try to involve the IDPs themselves in thinking about what should happen during a peace process. And so rather than looking at the IDPs as a problem, I think if we kind of flip that around and try to think about ways to creatively engage people who happen to be IDPs who have been victimized by the conflict and have been forced off their lands, if we try to open discussions with them and try to figure out what they would like to see happen in a peace process and how their needs might be met. I think that's really important. I think the element of participation is really important, that they're not just seen as a problem to be dealt with, but as a resource for dealing with the problem as well. I think the other question regarding war crimes and crimes against humanity and how the victims of those crimes look at issues of social justice or peace, you know, there's a lot of variation, and I don't think you can really generalize and say that victims think this. What I would say is that victims are becoming more organized in expressing what their concerns are and what their needs and desires are. I think that truth seems to figure high on the list of priorities for most people who have been affected by the violence. They want to know what happened to their loved ones. And then beyond that, I think there are a whole range of responses going from, you know, wanting trials or wanting impunity to be addressed or to not exist to, you know, I think there are legitimate desires for vengeance among people who have been victimized. I don't think that you can really generalize and say everyone wants reconciliation. I think that reconciliation is something that's very individual, very personal, and it's going to come about through different kinds of processes, both at the individual level and the collective level.
I agree with you, and you know, I would just like to note, Colombia has a long history of silencing victims. There has never been, and not that it's the be-all and the end-all, but a truth commission, mm-hmm. right? And so there haven't been spaces in which victims can simply get out into the open in whatever way that might occur, a kind of recognition of what happened. And many of the people that I've talked to long for, and you're right, it's very heterogeneous. Some people want to exact vengeance, so it's not, but there is a very strong desire for, I want a public acknowledgement that something happened here and not that something happened to someone I love, that something happened to me, that something happened, and a kind of acknowledgement of the responsibility of the state in allowing that to happen. I think that those are two very important things, and they have not happened. And one of the preoccupations, this goes back to an earlier question, is that I have, is the extensive nature of the surveillance network that has been implemented over the last two terms of the Uribe administration, because one of the most effective means, certainly in Antioquia, of silencing an incipient effort to actually have a public discussion about this, to ask, for instance, some of those leaders who were then extradited, before, as they were beginning to confess all kinds of things, right, was in fact to target those individuals, to follow them when they would appear, for instance, at the courthouse, when they participated in demonstrations, public demonstrations, to photograph them, to wiretap their telephones. It's quite extensive. And so then it becomes very difficult for there to be the kind of space in which potentially you could have a discussion of what it is that the different victims of violence might want. How would you balance justice and truth? Or is it reparations? Is it some kind of public acknowledgement? What would be? But I think it's a very important part that hasn't happened in Colombia, and if it doesn't happen, I actually don't see how you could have a successful peace negotiation. Even if you got to the table and you managed to work out all of the political issues, the fact that it's like a cancer, this thing that's hidden and remains hidden.
Mark?
The previous questioner probably knows this, but when the Pastrana government signed the Rome Treaty in July of 2002, they put a 7-year hiatus for the role of the ICC related to war crimes. Not all crimes, but just war crimes. They wanted to give a space of 7 years to find peace. Well, very few people realize this in Colombia, but this 7 years expires right now. So we've come to the end of those 7 years, and now the ICC has full jurisdiction. And the ICC has been poking around. The chief prosecutor, Luis Moreno Ocampo, has been in Colombia. He's concerned. Colombians are in contact with them. What Mary said just now is exactly right. The tradition in Colombia of post-conflict is Morón y Cuenta Nueva. As we erase and we start all over and we give an amnesty. That's the way it always was. When they first started peacemaking in the 80s, they just gave an amnesty, and that's the way. The genie's out of the bottle. That mode of operation is gone. I don't think the FARC understands this, in fact, because they just want an amnesty as if which they could have gotten in the 80s, they could have gotten in the 90s, they can't get today. The issue of justice is now
going to be part of any peace process, and the issue of truth and fact-finding is going to be part of any peace process. There's no way around that. And that makes peacemaking more difficult. But it will also make, I suspect, a more secure and lasting peace. And that's a very important development. And that's just a fact of the new terrain of peacemaking.
Adam?
Not much to add there. I'd say that for victims, though, two of the most dangerous things to organize around right now are to denounce the continuing power of the people who victimized you, who may still be in the military brigade or who may be in the mayor's office or who may be the largest landowners in the area where you are. And they still, even though, you know, the power relationship has not changed, the dismantlement has not happened, and it's still very hard to denounce that. It's also very hard to denounce or to get back what was stolen from you. Probably you can, you know, if you're a victims leader, you can start naming names and talking about how the military helped the paramilitaries and find, dig up mass graves like crazy, and nothing will happen. Maybe, likely nothing will happen to you. But start organizing to get back the hacienda that used to be your land, and you are in much greater danger. Land is the one thing that justice and peace process has made absolutely no progress on at all. And on the question of the IDPs, there are those who want to return, and for those who do want to return, the land question, I keep bringing up land, and I'm going to keep saying land, even though it's hideously complicated to understand, it is huge. Land looms large for returnees. Those who don't want to return and that's many. After 7 or 8 years on the outskirts of Medellin, you have electricity, you have maybe potable water, you can watch television, and all that goes away if you go back to a very remote village. The state services are essential. Reparations, in any case, are essential. And I think that the victims' law that was recently defeated in the Colombian Congress actually represented the aspirations of a lot of victims, and it was centered on reparations. And finally, if you're going to be helping IDPs, not discriminating between them and the rest of the community. There's a strange, segmentation of assistance in Colombia. You're a displaced person. You're a demobilized person. You're a victim as such, and people who happen to live in the communities will wonder why, my neighbor on the finca next door is getting, he's getting 100,000 pesos a month in technical assistance, and they're digging him a well. Well, what about me? Just because I didn't leave, why should I be penalized? You have to actually help entire communities.
Last two questions.
My name is Jim Jones. I have an article in the book. Several comments have been made with regard to how one gets peace and how one addresses the FARC, which is the major insurgency. And I probably should have made notes on the things that I wanted to comment on, so I'm just going to try to recall very quickly and add to some of this, since I have talked with the insurgents at a fairly high level on several occasions. And one of the things that, first off, and as far as demobilization goes, I think it's in everybody's best interest that the FARC be demobilized as a group. And that has it's going to require some special treatment, which I won't get into at the moment. One of the things that, at a very high level, the FARC are very sensitive to, and that is the human suffering that they have gone through, with the UP experience and others, that they don't think is recognized, and especially by the Uribe government. And so this as somebody, I think Cindy asked, about or paramilitaries, what can be done. I think one thing is going to, that, from the point of view of the FARC, they're going to have to see that there is a concern on the part of Colombian authorities to bring the paramilitaries to some sort of justice. And here is where I think the U.S. could play a major role. I don't agree that there is no opportunity to negotiate with the FARC. Nor do I think that it makes much sense to talk about demobilization, and they're going to put down their arms anytime soon. That's not going to happen. And demobilization, as far as this group is concerned, the FARC, is going to require some direction down the path of addressing their political project. Mm-hmm. And that political project is not hard to support. I mean, Mark Chernik brought this out. Agrarian issues are sort of central. They remain central to the FARC. They're central also to Alfonso Cano, okay, not just to Marulanda, okay, the late Marulanda, the FARC chief. So that's going to have to be addressed. And any sort of peace process, okay, long before demobilization, is going to have, the FARC are going to have to believe that there is some sincere effort being made on the part of the Colombian state to move down the direction of addressing some of these issues. You know, what the issues precisely are, how one does it, how far one goes, all of that's part of the negotiations. I think the reason I say that the FARC would be open right now is that from the point of view of the FARC, the U.S. has been the major international supporter of the Colombian establishment and the status quo. And I mean, the U.S. put in the heavy military aid component of the FARC. Even the Obama administration has been pretty soft on Uribe. The comments that I hear so far are not very encouraging to me. But if the U.S. were to suddenly say, look, we want to talk with the FARC, a terrorist organization, that's going to require some doing, I know that. But if you really want peace, this is what's going to have to be done. The U.S. would step in and do that and would force Uribe, okay, as a starting point, to take this humanitarian prisoner swap seriously, which I don't think he does. This would sort of open some doors. But if the U.S. would step in and do that, the FARC, I think, would be willing to talk seriously. And I honestly and firmly believe that, and that is based on conversations at a very high level within the past, shortly before the bombing of Reyes camp. And it wasn't just Reyes. I talked with Ivan Marquez and with several other top-level commanders. And the FARC, they talk a lot of ideology. There's a lot of Marxist terminology involved. Marx is very special because Colombia is a society organized along class lines, very rigid class lines. And this, for somebody with a Marxist background, has a very special echo to it. There's a lot of Bolivarianism that's sort of mixed in with the Marx. But in terms of what they're willing to do, there is a great gap between the ideological rhetoric and what they would do if they felt that the government, the U.S., the government in Colombia, would sit down and talk seriously with them, would recognize that they do have a right at the table, recognize they have to have a space, and recognize the suffering that they have gone through. Now, I'm not, everything is so polarized right now that if I say things like this, I get accused of being FARC sympathizer. Okay, I'm not. The FARC have committed enormous human rights abuses. Enormous. And they will have to answer to these as other elements in the conflict will have to answer to them, including the Colombian military. But if you really want peace, the time, I think, where that could, the doors could be open to make that happen is now. That's my point, okay?
Very quickly. We're running out of room, I think.
Absolutely. My name is Dodge Fielding. I work with the Institute for Multi-Track Diplomacy, and we have a program called Score for Peace that uses sports, soccer specifically, in reintegration processes. And I had a question. One, the only thing that has not been covered by the panel is that I would like to ask as a question is economic opportunity and reintegration in the process in Colombia. And we'll talk offline about this, but I'd like to ask you all to talk a little bit, just to address briefly, the what measures can be taken by NGOs and by the Colombian government to reintegrate the IDP community in the areas that have already been quasi-pacified in urban areas. And we'll talk a little bit about some of those initiatives.
Two rather distinct subject areas, but anybody want to take a shot at either of them?
Well, I'll say very briefly, I mean, the most important thing is you have to stop stigmatizing the IDPs. And that is a difficult thing to do, because while you can imagine having forcing a government to cease to refer to particular individuals, to be held accountable for referring flippantly to individuals as terrorists that can put them at risk, what is much harder to do is to enforce that in the broader civilian population. So what happens is that IDPs arrive, for instance, in urban areas and neighborhoods, and they're immediately assumed to bring with them a considerable amount of risk. That is, they're either it's horrible. They're assumed to be from zonas calientes and to be sympathizers by guerrillas, or you'll hear people say, algo deben, they must owe something. And immediately they're on the defensive. They're the individuals who have to prove that, in fact, they suffered a loss and were forced to leave, not that they are the harbingers of greater violence for these particular communities. So one of the very first things and I think that's something, dare I say it, it sounds romantic, it's almost an issue of sort of a national crusade to really address the issue of the ways in which victims and IDPs have been stigmatized and portrayed. There was an attempt to do that. In the media, for instance, there were these commercials intended to sort of raise consciousness. At least they had them in Medellin. But people just kind of laughed at them and turned them off. But that would be the very first thing. You would have to create a climate and a kind of broad public national awareness that this is a very serious issue and that these individuals are victims and not perpetrators themselves of violence.
I'm going to suggest, since we have to apparently evacuate,
to
have Jenny make the last comment for all of us.
All right. I just wanted to address this particular question and say that I think that it would be helpful if we saw the kind of concerted effort to help ex-combatants that we need to see to help IDPs. I think that there has been an effort.
Four million versus 30,000.
USIP has actually supported two studies. The Fundación Ideas para la Paz, Ideas for Peace Foundation, conducted a study and a process with the business sector and the ex-combatants to try to understand why the business sector was not being more forthcoming with providing economic opportunities and jobs specifically for ex-combatants. We've just approved this week a second grant to the Ideas para la Paz to look at this same situation with IDPs and to bring the business community in to the table to discuss the question of IDPs and what more the business community can be doing vis-a-vis that population.
And on that note, let me thank you.
Thank you.